A whole bunch of us, we just try to make it, just try to make it real. That's Les McCann with Trying to Make It Real on Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, October the 18th, and we pick up from where we left off with each other just yesterday. There seemed to be a lot of traffic. We wanted to know what you're thinking. And that's easy to do, 1-888-874-4888, 1-888-874-4888. We want to move along briskly today, so I'll ask you to be as pointed as you possibly can with your thoughts and your comments. We're looking for how you assess the political situation, what your thoughts are about that. Try to be as specific as you can. Yesterday, we had quite a few calls, people just, as they say, riffing on the debate, the second round of debates. And I got to tell you, I still am waiting for a debate. I still am waiting for a debate. I used to debate, as a matter of fact. I used to be on my school debating team. And back in the day, when chickens had teeth. And so I kind of have an idea of what a debate ought to look like and sound like. I'm still waiting for one to happen. It hasn't happened yet. This business of ultra-scripted scenarios where months and months of negotiations are held and, limitations are placed on what may be asked and what may not be asked. People who are deputized to negotiate in behalf of others and rehearsals and all this kind of nonsense, which basically, as I said, goes to the idea that much of what we are seeing and much of what is being presented to us as public discourse is really ultra-scripted. It is designed to have specific effect and impact. It is carefully choreographed. It is literally marketing. It is what people call branding. You have to consider each of the candidates as a brand, which, of course, each of the candidates is a brand. It is true. And so it is about their message. It is about impressing you in a particular way to persuade you to do what they want you to do. And obviously, they're not going to let you know everything you ought to know. They're going to be quite selective about what it is you know, because this is engineered consent. As Noam Chomsky would call it, manufactured consent. This is about people having an outcome in mind and playing the odds and in a very scientific way, trying to predict how you are going to react. And therefore, with that in mind, what is the message they need to craft to grab your attention and to keep your loyalty? because the big prize is the White House. It is the big prize. And in pursuit of that, billions of dollars will be spent. By the time November 6th rolls around, the Barack Obama camp would have spent in excess of, or raised in excess of $1 billion. And between Obama and Romney, you would have in excess of about $5 or $6 billion spent. This is how insane the situation is. And you contrast that against public professions of how mindful each of the candidates is about how hard times are, and the yawning gap between rich and poor, and the cuts that are looming because the country is now facing what they're now calling this economic fiscal cliff. We have everybody warning about it. The same people who were bailed out, and Morgan Stanley and Deutsche Bank and whoever else, the long list, Wells Fargo. All these folks who were bailed out are now wagging a finger saying, listen, yes, you did give us money, and for that we're grateful. Well, we're not really grateful because it is the right thing to do, after all. You did the right thing, and you bailed us out. But now we have concerns about you and your capacity to make decisions. And we are saying that it is time for Congress to get its act together and bail us out once more from this fiscal cliff that we are facing, these multi-trillion dollar deficits that keep rising every single day. Of course, we have had a lame duck Congress. They've done nothing. They've done nothing to articulate a budget in 3 years. This is the do-nothingest Congress we've seen in a long, long time. And even as we speak, they're, roaming their constituencies because they want to get reelected to do nothing. And this do-nothing Congress is now going to have to confront the first thing that when they return, hopefully, it would be returning with some fresh new faces. But let's hope that they would actually get their act together. Let's hope they actually understand that they are representatives of people, that there's an obligation here to exercise some really insightful leadership. And just, could we have a budget? Is it too much to ask that we should have a budget? But we have these games being played. And don't forget, the vast majority of people in Congress, in the House, in the U.S. Senate, can afford to play these waiting games because they're millionaires. They're multimillionaires. A huge chunk of Congress and almost all of the Senate are millionaires. They don't have to worry about where their bills, whether their bills are going to be paid, whether their kids' college tuition is going to be there, whether, they could either actually afford to get sick. They don't have to worry about these things. So in their view, if they could tough it out as they see it, certainly the nation could tough it out. And so we have gone 3 years without a budget. And this is acceptable. And we have all the finger pointing about who's not doing what, and they all are lousy. They all ought to go. We ought to invent the biggest broom we've ever seen and sweep them all out. They've got to go. They are detrimental to the interests of this country. In some parts of the world, a Congress that performs like this would be declared hostile to the nation and would be forced to resign and disband. But here we believe in democracy. We're so democratically oriented that we would tolerate this kind of nonsense in this day and age. 1-888-874-4888. We continue with your discussions on what ails America and what you think might be workable solutions to the problems that you see. We'll take the short break and come back to your thoughts. 1-888-874-4888. Again, I ask you to be as concise and as pointed as possible. But, of course, be prepared to engage in some serious discussion. Mm-hmm. Is that you? Is that you? Are you trying to make it just like me, trying to make it real? This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we're trying to figure out, what is it? What is your reality today? What do you see as the problem? You know, a great deal of wisdom rests in regular folk. And despite the fact that all this money is being spent to deceive us and to mislead us and to throw us off the track, we do still have an innate sense of something being fundamentally wrong. And no matter what they try to do, it's not going away. That feeling is as legitimate as it gets, because it hits at a visceral gut level. You can't deny it. Trouble all around. And how did we get here? And can we just say, well, it's the politicians? Well, yeah, it's the politicians. But then we are in charge of that, aren't we? Aren't we the ones who elect these folks and who refuse to make them accountable and who keep re-electing them and putting them and now causing them to create misery for us? And every 4 years we go through this ridiculous exercise, and you feel like, you know, the hoop with, and the dog jumps through the hoop, and you perform according to conditioning and plan. It's time to stop that. It's a very bad habit. I had said to, in my talks, I do a lot of community talks, and I had said, especially in the African American community, we have to rethink this business of voting. Yesterday, we had a caller who said that she is not going to vote. And I asked her, I said, well, you know, so much has been invested. It is said that this is pretty much treasonous, practically, for an African-American person, given the history of getting this right to vote, to not vote. Why would you do a thing like that? And from her point of view, and she said it, I have to have something to vote for. And that is a profound thing. You have to have something to vote for. What are we voting for? I have trouble all around. And it's not, I'm tired of the choices of, well, choose the evil of the two lessers, essentially, as opposed to the lesser of two evils. You know, you cannot abide this anymore. It is intolerable. The very concept of democracy, it seems to be, has become so corrupted, has become so irrelevant. It's become such a cynical joke that this Hollywood Busby Berkeley production of an election just only reinforces the contempt that you feel coming from people who do know what is at stake, because they are the stakeholders. They are the people at the center of power. But still, we have to find a strategy. Okay, you have a vote. What do you do? I had advocated a long time ago that the Democratic Party, especially for African Americans, and I say that because the African American community has a ridiculous loyalty to this party. For what reason, I don't know. It is, if anybody bothered to look, it is the party of slavery, really, as much as the Republicans. It is the party of Southern Dixiecrats and segregationists. And as we see today, it is the party of exclusion. So what is it about this compelling need to affiliate ourselves with a party that literally has nothing but contempt and disrespect for your actual needs? I mean, you have to consider the irony of it. We have a person of color as a president who has yet to discuss with this particular constituency that played a critical role in his political victory in 2008. And prior to that, as a guy wanting to run for state senate in Chicago. It was the black community that created this idea of his, this audacity of hope, shall I put it, that he could go on to do other things. But there is that similarity in trajectory. We have a horrible history in the African American community of creating monsters, people who do not get it. Every now and then, we have an exception, and the exception for Barack Obama should have been right there. He should have patterned himself. He had a ready point of reference in the late Harold Washington, mayor of Chicago. Now, there was a guy who didn't fool around. He was an organically grown product. He was of the people. He was for the people. And there was no question about that. We have some examples around the country. We had the late Adam Clayton Powell Jr. Didn't take any guff. And there were no questions, especially within his constituency, as to where his loyalties were. It was very clear. And at a time when this country was steeped in segregation, when Adam Clayton Powell, who could have passed for white, couldn't get his hair cut in the halls of Congress, couldn't get his hair cut, couldn't invite African-American people to have lunch with him, and yet was the most prolific legislator practically of all time. Here's a guy literally climbing the rough side of a mountain and did it. The minimum wage, Adam Clayton Powell. Student loans, Adam Clayton Powell. Worker safety laws, Adam Clayton Powell. And the list goes on of the essential tools that we take for granted today did not come from the mainstream of the party. They came from an upstart, Adam Clayton Powell. And why was he so effective? He was effective because he came from a constituency that pledged its faith to him, and his faith was pledged to them. Not just the geographic boundaries. Adam Clayton Powell struggled, of course, for all people in the United States. But he had a very important point of reference and a very special loyalty to an extremely distressed community that was not geographic. I mean, it went all the way to Cambodia. He responded to injustice. And we do have that kind of fire. We have Bernie Sanders. And the lone independent in Congress. And the longest lasting in the history of politics in Congress. A very extraordinary person. But that kind of fire is not the kind of fire we see generally. Many elected officials think of this as a gig. It's a gig. And it's some of the best thing that they can do with themselves. You know, they get status. They get power. They, you know, hobnob with the hobnobbables. They earn a pretty decent living. They are assured a retirement and health benefits. And you know, they do all right. So it becomes a personal quest for many of them, as opposed to a popular mandate. First, it's them. And if there's anything left over, well, maybe the rest of the folks can get something. But they're there not to really tend to the affairs of state. They're there to tend to their own personal agendas as a priority. And that's the way it is across the board. There may be a couple of exceptions, but that's what they are. They are just a couple of exceptions. A couple of exceptions. So when, with political fervor, they show up in the 4-year plan, and they tell you how great they are, how necessary they are to continued progress, how vitally important it is that they be returned to the halls of power so that they can secure our collective security and increase our quality of life and assure us of all these wonderful things that they can do once they get back in. We have to start saying no. Just, you're all saying, you see, just say no, Nancy Reagan, just say no. We can't have this anymore. We can't have it from the Republican Party. We can't have it from the Democratic Party. We can't have it from any party, including any third party, and especially perhaps any third party. And I've made my points about the third party issue, about this repeated failures, repeated losses. I'm tired of that, because it tells me that the third parties are not doing what they're supposed to do. And they're simply constructing parallels to an undesirable system. They're not understanding that the onus is on them to craft a new way. And if you adopt the methods and the tools of an oppressive system, you are part of an oppressive system. Simply because you are a parallel structure does not give you any greater credibility. And personally, it is time, I think, for third-party initiatives to really be subjected to a reality check. Because it seems to me that they simply are frittering away very vitally needed resources and time and energy in this pursuit of saying, well, we are also in the game. That's not even a cogent argument. It's not even smart to say. You can enter the fray at any time, but be ready when you enter. Be ready with a plan. Be ready with a structure that assures success. And it doesn't have to be grandiose, because we know that cannot obtain. It will not fly. But you articulate modest goals. You come up with an achievable and a workable plan. And you work to succeed at it. And that is vitally important. I've had it with losing. And it does me no good. I'm not interested in anybody telling me, well, these are, you know, the progressives and the liberal. I don't want to hear that stuff. You've been progressive and liberal and losing for a long time. So get your progressive liberal self together. Losing is not attractive. Because you should have a handle by now on the science of politics. You should have a handle on how it works. And if you don't have a handle on it, get out. Don't bother. Don't waste anybody's time. Don't try and, you know, get some people to invest in a losing proposition. I come back to this business that the left of center is itself under some strange delusions as to what politics really is all about. They keep bombarding me and others with their philosophy. Who cares? I'm not interested in a philosophical lesson. I'm interested in your plan for change. We'll figure out your philosophy later. Your philosophy is part of your plan for change. So don't spend time telling me about your philosophy, about how radical you are, or how liberal you are, or how progressive you are. It means nothing to me. Because I'm interested in your structure. I'm interested in your plan. I'm interested in your articulated goals. I'm interested in what you are going to do, and what you reasonably can do successfully to achieve the modest goals that you have. Now, if that makes sense, then I therefore sign on to whatever it is you say your philosophy is. I can judge it based on your approach, based on your plan. But simply to tell me what you stand for, well, hey, that is not moving us forward. Simply to tell me what I ought to be thinking doesn't get us anywhere. I am into pragmatic, doable, achievable goals. And I don't care about how small they are, how big they are. I want to know that they are focused, and I want to know that those goals are tied to a delivery system. Now, this is where Barack Obama is instructive. Here is a guy who clearly had an ambition. There are other people around him who had ambitions too, and still do have. And there was a marriage of sorts. We still are unraveling who those hidden hands are and what the hidden agendas have been and continue to be. But what is instructive about Obama is nobody saw him coming. Nobody saw the juggernaut that overwhelmed them. Ostensibly, in the world of politics, as political scientists really study it, he really didn't have a prayer. But he realized something very important very early. When I say he, I mean him and his creators or manipulators or owners or whatever it is, his group, his band. They realized something, that even within the Democratic Party, he was going to have a trouble. So they had to construct a system. You construct a system, and no matter what your politics are, you have to construct a system. You can't just have thoughts in your head, and you can't just have ideas. You have to have a system. And the system that he constructed had never been seen before. They did a fantastic job. Because what did it do? It helped him raise money, lots and lots and lots of money. It helped him build constituencies with a rapid pace never seen before. It helped him create his own cudgel, his own hammer, because he now is an organized entity and not within the Democratic Party structure. He still owns his own system. He still owns, you notice, he's not lending it to anybody. He's not lending it to any other Democrat. This is his system. So if at any time the party decides that it could do without him, which is crazy because he has a system and the party does not. He has a system now that the party does not have despite its existence for decades and decades and decades. He has the wherewithal to independently wield power because he has a system. You can't get around it. And this is a really tough nut to crack with my liberal and progressive friends who think that it's all about getting into the communities and talking to people about what it is they're thinking. Who cares what you're thinking? I want to see what you're doing. Because from what I see, you're not doing very much. You cannot run a campaign and raise money and build a constituency and transmit your ideas and win all at the same time. It can't be done, especially when you are so stressed financially to do these things. You have to think smarter. So yours is, by necessity, a long-term plan. A long-term plan, however, of thinking and action, not talking, organizing, building, recruiting, constructing, negotiating, and moving across all the historic hurdles. But guess what? I walk around the community. I have yet to see a single Green Party poster anywhere, or that they're calling a community meeting, or that they're present when the community board meets. I have yet to see any of the liberal parties or the Justice Party or any other party. They're not here in the community. So when you show up every 4 years and you start telling people what a great person you are, how do you think that you are actually gaining the confidence of people? Because you're engaging in the same business that the regulars do. They basically dismiss you, and you become important every 4 years. And yet this very simple thing is key to the success of any new movement. You cannot behave like the people that you don't like and get a different result. So coming back to Barack Obama, what is very, very important to understand about him in terms of his approach to politics is that it's extremely scientific. The minute he declared he was ready to run for a national office as a guy who had no reason to think that he could get it done, the minute he declared it, he knew within a pretty decent degree of certainty that he would be an extraordinarily important and formidable contender and a likely victor. He knew that going in. Why? Because they put together their system. And even now, as I said, he's not lending it to anybody. He's not making it available to any Democrat, because it is a pioneering system. We have, many of us, have automatic disdain for systems. We don't like systems. We don't like order. We don't like structure. We just like to talk about things. But structure is where it's at. Order is where it's at. If you're battling chaos, you cannot be equally chaotic. If you're battling a well-ordered system, you cannot be chaotic. You have to have a system. You have to have something that says you are proceeding with a plan in a methodical way. And the reason you're doing it that way is because you have studied things. And you understand the relationship between science and outcomes. This is not a game of chance. We're all too old for games of chance. Between the time that Jesse Jackson first announced, I'm just using Jackson as a benchmark, in 1984 till now, we've lost a generation's worth of opportunity to do something. And it's all because this chaos ensued, this laissez-faire attitude, this entire move to center a movement around a personality with an inordinate need for attention. And instead of it being a broad movement, it becomes an ego-centered movement. And that's where the third-party movements are going. Oh, it's Ralph Nader. Well, yeah, that's great. But Ralph Nader, what is your relationship to the African-American community? And don't be so snotty as to believe that people ought to know and they ought to value you because you've been a consumer advocate. Well, great, you've been a consumer advocate. What, therefore, is your responsibility? Is to engage in education. You don't stand up on a hill just like the Democrats do and say, I'm smart, you ought to know it, you ought to come to me. You ought to have your senses about you, and you ought to put your faith in me. No, that is racist, plain and simple. That kind of thinking ought to go. If you're thinking as an evolved person, in this day and age, you understand the need to educate people, and it is your responsibility. That's why I'm saying the Green Party, people are supposed to just wake up and have an epiphany about the Green Party and say, hey, you know what? I'm for the Green Party. Why? Because it's, well, it's green. If you have no involvement in a community, if you're not seen, let alone heard in the community, if you have no physical attachment to a community, then you are just like everybody else. But if you do mean to be different, you would work very hard at inculcating a level of relevance, and therefore you get support for your ideas. But we have this notion that people are just ought to know better. You know, I'm a liberal. Okay, great. So therefore you could trust me. No, you might be one of the most racist people on the planet. And many people don't even understand the political labels they assign to themselves. If I were to ask a libertarian, the average libertarian, what is a libertarian? He wouldn't tell me, wouldn't be able to. If I ask the top five people in the Democratic Party, what is the philosophy of the Democratic Party? If I ask the top five Republicans, including Mitt Romney, what is exactly the philosophy of the Republican Party? They wouldn't be able to tell me. Or if they do, you get 10 different answers. People don't know what informs their political decisions anymore as a party. This is not a country of party the way you see it in Britain or some places in Europe or in the Caribbean or in Africa. It is essentially built on this notion of rugged individualism. It's all about me. You're voting for me. And you ought to trust me. I mean, Joe Biden said it. Do you trust? And this is why I say it's a sales meeting. Do you, like a used car salesman, he asks the nation, who would you trust? Would you trust him or would you trust me? Now, who would respect a question like that? Am I, as a voter, supposed to be talking about who do I trust? I don't know either of you. I don't trust either of you. And I shouldn't be asked about trusting. This is not about trust. This is about hard, cold facts. What are you delivering? William, you're on the air from California.
Hi. What a wonderful show you have. I've never heard you before, and I hope to hear you often in the future. My question is this. Can President Obama use executive privilege to get through some of the Republican deadlock the next 4 years? And what are the limitations of using that? It seems like President Bush might have used it often. I'm not sure, though.
Well, I think that it is less an issue about whether the president always has executive privilege. I'm sorry?
Did you hear me okay?
I just missed your last statement, though. Go ahead.
Okay. Didn't President Bush use that often?
Well, presidents use it as they see fit. What we ought to understand, though, is the use of any executive order comes within a really nasty environment. And the nasty environment is this country has been leadership-less for literally almost 4 years now. And it's not just the president. I'm talking about the House and the Senate. They haven't done anything. They haven't even put a budget together. In the real world, this would be cause for dismissal. This is almost as close as you can get to an act of treason. When people who are charged with the health and safety and welfare of a country so blithely dismiss it and chalk it up to political differences in party politics, this is intolerable. So if we have any reason to believe in our democratic rights, it should be that we should have had a referendum on whether we want these people hanging in at all. We should have been able to cancel their contracts publicly. If they can't come up with a budget, it must mean that they are incapable of leadership. And we ought to have the ability to reject that and send them home. You know, I can't see where in the private sector I can have a job as, let's say, a controller of a company, and then the company president is saying, well, how are we looking? And I say, well, I don't know. I really haven't looked at the books, and still expect to have a job. But what Congress is doing and has been doing, the Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives, in the real world, they would be charged under the RICO statutes, the Federal Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act. These are people conspiring to commit fraud, to commit a fraud against the American people. And they do it under the color of law. They're protected as legislators. But the fact is, this is a conspiracy to do nothing. So whether the president exercises his executive powers, and that will start a whole new conversation about, you know, the constitutionality of his authority to do anything with respect to executive orders. We don't know, but it's just politics. And at the base of it is we have a putrid Congress, and they ought to be swept out. All of them ought to go, and we therefore should have a referendum on who we let back in. Thank you, William, for your call. Thanks so much. I mean, that's where we ought to be. If we take ourselves seriously, we cannot possibly hand the reins of power over to these folks. They have no incentive to do anything in the interest of the people. They know that they have that protection. They're isolated and insulated against the people. There's very little, really, that we can do. I likened our situation to being a passenger in a 15-passenger van being driven by a maniac down the road. And you're all the way in the back seat, and you can't put your hands on the steering wheel. You can't press the brake. You can't do anything to stop this maniacal driver from taking you hurtling down the highway to your death. That's exactly what this is. And the apparatus of government has been very successful at being impervious to public interference, which is what they think of us as. We are interfering. But 4 years, every 4 years, they'll tell you what a great thing. They invite you in, as we were invited at this last round of the debates. Well, anyway, as we close out, we come to the close of the program, I want to remind you to stay tuned. Mike Feder is up next with Occupied Territory and Brilliant Mind. I want to thank you very much for your comments. You can reach me always at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com. And if you are inclined to show up at a wonderful concert to help a 118-year-old institution that has a phenomenal past in the abolitionist movement, join me at 1 o'clock at St. James Presbyterian Church for a concert in Harlem. It's going to be a wonderful, wonderful thing. To ask about tickets, call 212-283-4541. 212-283-4541. And meet me at 1 o'clock. I'll be there. And just say, hey, is your trees in the house? And I'll say yes, and we'll get to meet. Okay? Thank you so much. Tomorrow we talk about affirmative action, but not what you think. Right? Bye-bye. Just don't fake it. I'm not trying. I'm just trying to make it real. Yes, I'm.